From the Sky News Centre at 6, the World Cup's begun in spectacular fashion. The opening ceremony at the soccer stadium saw 1,500 people performing a choreographed dance, creating a map of Africa. The first match has been played as well. South Africa and Mexico's game finished 1-1. Despite that, these fans in Johannesburg are delighted.
At least you didn't lose, it was a draw.
We're so happy for Bafana. Bafana, it did disappoint us, and everybody here in the happy mood.
Played an awesome game, world-class football, capitalizing our chances, becoming 2-0 next time.
There's one more game tonight as Uruguay face France. Meanwhile, England's players have been training for the final time ahead of their World Cup opener. There are just 24 hours to go until their match with the USA in Rustenburg. In other news, three former Labour MPs and a Tory peer will stand trial over fiddling their expenses. A judge has today ruled that they are not immune from prosecution under parliamentary privilege. BP shares have bounced back after ministers moved to defend the oil firm. It's come in for perceived Britain bashing by President Obama over the spill in the Gulf of Mexico. The Prince of Wales has met members of the emergency services who dealt with last week's gun massacre in Cumbria. 12 people were killed and 11 injured when Derek Bird went on his shooting spree 11 days ago. Facial surgeon at North Cumbria University Hospital, Graham Putnam, spoke to Prince Charles.
Well, he was very interested in everyone's role in the events that unfolded last week and how we'd coped and some of the things that we'd had to deal with.
The former UN weapons inspector Hans Blix is to be questioned by the inquiry into the Iraq war. The former Deputy Prime Minister John Prescott is also on the list of 35 witnesses due to be called during a fresh round of hearings. And Natalie Imbruglia has been confirmed as a guest judge for The X Factor. She'll stand in for Danny Minogue during the Birmingham auditions. Katy Perry and Pixie Lott are also due to appear in the show. That's the latest. I'm Chris Giles.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
You think you have a problem with cocaine or other drugs? Cocaine Anonymous can help. Visit our website www.cauk.org.uk. We're here and we're free. Call 0800 612 0225.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Are you discouraged or disheartened? Are you in distress or in debt? Do you feel that you are unlucky? Does your child need help with schoolwork? If you have answered yes to any one of the questions, come and learn how to become a champion and be victorious over these challenges using dynamic biblical principles at Champions House. Every Sunday, 12 to 2, City Academy, Bristol, Carlton House, Redfield. www.championshouse.com.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Welcome back to Friday Drive Time. We'll be having a listen in a minute to Prime Minister David Cameron's keynote speech earlier this week, where he explains, or at least tries to, why the drastic cuts in public services are necessary right now. The banksters, however, have got away with £700 billion of Treasury bailout money. The power to regulate the city as well has gone from the Financial Services Authority, which is funded by the banking industry, to the Bank of England, which is also a private bank, part of the financial banking industry. Anyway, so what's that, Martin?
The Bank of England is not ostensibly a private institution, unlike the Federal Reserve. You could argue that it's been regulatory captured, that the City of London has an overwhelming influence on its policy, but it is officially part of the British government. It's not a private bank like the Federal Reserve.
So the Monetary Policy Committee, how's that decided on then?
Well, it's decided on by the Bank of England in consultation with the government. But it is a government institution. You could argue that it's a government institution which has been captured by the interests of the City of London. The Federal Reserve is actually a private institution masquerading as a public institution, but you can't say the same of the Bank of England.
What about the shareholdings of the Bank of England? Because obviously some people have shares in it. Do you know?
I don't believe they do.
This may be a good time to introduce Bob Wellham. Now, hi, Bob, and welcome to Drive Time.
Hello.
Can you tell us, first of all, what is the Money Reform Party?
It's a group of individuals who would like to drastically change the way money comes into circulation, basically what money is. At the moment, our means of exchange, the numbers in your bank account, have all been borrowed into existence. your savings are someone else's debt. Now, there's no fundamental reason why that should be the case. As a nation, as a trading community, a trading people, we can have our own means of exchange, which we issue for ourselves, debt-free, thereafter to use for our business.
So, Bob, why haven't I ever heard of the Monetary Reform Party before?
We're very small, I suppose. I can't really answer that question. Why is it not widely publicised by the mainstream media? I don't know.
And are there any decent journals where you can keep up to, with the issues that your party is espousing, or you know, where can people come across these kinds of issues being discussed, if not in the mainstream media?
Okay, well, you can go to the website, which is www.moneyreformparty.co.uk, all one word, Money Reform Party. And a recent development is people, some of whom are members of the Money Reform Party and some are independent, have formulated the Bank of England Act 2010, which is a formal proposal for the reform of our monetary system. It's been put together by very dedicated and very bright people, and I'd recommend that if you're interested in this subject, you go and have a look at it. That's at www.bankofenglandact.co.uk.
And how about you then? What's your education and professional background?
I'm a PhD mathematician who led a very normal sort of life in academia, in industrial research, and I earned money, I spent it, I invested it, and it wasn't until I retired that I had time to think about what money was. I realised that my four children were all financially worse off than I had been at their age. The newspapers were full of stories that individuals, corporations, nations were all in debt. So as a sort of logical thinking person, I wondered, to whom were they all in debt? Couldn't be the Martians, so that must be that I don't understand money, and that motivated me to look more deeply into it.
Okay, now, as promised, let's have a listen to the Prime Minister David Cameron speaking about the economy and explaining in detail why the axe must fall, and he did that earlier this week.
Now, I've been in office for a month, and I've spent much of that time discussing with the Chancellor, with government officials, the most urgent issue facing Britain today, and that is our massive deficit and our growing debt. How we deal with these things will affect our economy and our society, indeed our whole way of life. The decisions we make will affect every single person in this country, and the effects of those decisions will stay with us for years, perhaps even decades to come. And it's precisely because these decisions are so momentous, because they will have such enormous implications, and because we cannot afford either to duck them or to get them wrong, that I want to make sure we go about the urgent task of cutting our deficit in a way that is open, responsible, and fair. I want this government to carry out Britain's unavoidable deficit reduction plan in a way that tries to strengthen and unite our country at the same time. I've said before that as we deal with the debt crisis, we must take the whole country with us, and I mean it. George Osborne has said that our plans to cut the deficit must be based on the belief that we are all in this together, and he means it.
Well, David Cameron there explaining how we are all in it together, Martin.
Well, I think that's political spin. Clearly they want to cut the deficit. I mean, the fundamental thing I would say about that little clip there is the fundamental problem facing us isn't the deficit. The fundamental problem facing us is the economic crisis, which includes the deficit. The deficit is one of the aspects of the economic crisis. But what David Cameron there is conflating the whole economic crisis to the deficit, which is frankly economically illiterate, apart from anything else. But it's the kind of thing that people have bought into to a large extent because the population at large is largely economically illiterate, as I'm sure our guest will explain in a little while.
But, I mean, you're really swimming against the tide here, aren't you? Because this decision's already been made. The cuts are going to happen. It's just whereabouts they're going to happen.
Well, that's the way it's been
presented. We've just had a general election.
We had a general election where the mandate for cuts is not at all clear, frankly. It's a rigged system, as we've said many times on this programme. It's actually rigged to allow the establishment in this country to retain control. And the establishment in this country very much includes the City of London. They want cuts, or some of them do. I think that they're all wrong. That in actual fact, cuts at this moment will not help the economy. Then they won't. The really killer point is that it won't actually reduce the deficit. The cuts will crash the economy and increase the deficit, and then we'll be in a crashed economy with a bigger deficit. Going, oh, what do we do now? The Tories have simply not taken on board the fact that their neoliberal policies of the last 30 years are over and finished, and this kind of talk will be shown to be completely wrong within 18 months, I guarantee it.
Okay, let's have another listen now, because we've got several of these clips, to Mr. Cameron.
There are three simple reasons why we have to deal with the country's debts. One, the more the government borrows, the more it has to repay. The more it has to repay, the more lenders worry about getting their money back. And the more lenders start to worry, the less confidence there is in our economy.
Well, I agree that the deficit needs to be reduced to some extent, although everybody now accepts that some deficit is actually quite useful at this moment. I mean, for the last 30 years, we've been told that deficits are a no-no. Suddenly, everybody's realised that they're actually essential, especially when you've got an economy that's going down. So you don't, in fact, want to decrease the deficit by too much. But clearly, we've got to do something to decrease the deficit. The obvious place to do that is through wealth taxes on those who have done, but maybe just a windfall tax on the wealthy classes who've done so well out of the last 30 years. Now, we're not hearing about that. We're hearing about cuts in adult care and all the things that we're talking about in the first part of the programme. Just stupidity, frankly, won't work.
Two, investors, people lending us this money, they don't have to put their money in Britain. They will only do so if they are confident that the economy is being run properly, and if confidence in our economy is hit, we run the risk of higher interest rates.
That is, of course, true, but it may be that by cutting the deficit, you actually crash the economy and confidence in the economy evaporates anyway. I mean, that's what may well happen here. They simply haven't taken on board that the times have changed. They're just coming out with the same old 1980s rhetoric, which is completely irrelevant to our changed circumstances. The financial system has imploded. That's what they need to put their mind to thinking about solving that problem. And as we were saying in the first part of the programme, it's who is it that's lending us this money? It wouldn't be David Cameron himself, would it, who's worth £5 million. Oh, what does he do with his £5 million? Well, he lends it to us, doesn't he? To us. And now he's saying, well, I won't get my money back. Or people like him won't get their money back. Now, the fact of the matter is that we've got to have a massive redistribution of wealth. There's been malinvestment, which is what von Hayek and von Mises would call it. There's been no real profits made, but people are sitting on huge chunks of money which were based on nothing at all. That's not their money, that's our money, and we want it back. And that's how we're going to reduce the deficit. It's the only way.
Three, and the real human everyday reason that this is the most urgent problem facing Britain is that higher interest rates hurt every family and every business in our land. They mean higher mortgage rates and lower employment. They mean that instead of your taxes going to pay for the things we all want, like schools and hospitals and police, your money, the money you work so hard for, is going on paying the interest on our national debt.
Do you want me to comment on that? That is essentially correct, and therefore we should not, in fact, be running up too much national debt. We need to run up some national debt because you need to prime the pump and keep the economy going. You don't want to crash it. But nevertheless, we've got to reduce the deficit. Now, the way to do that is to actually raise taxes on property and wealth and reform the monetary system so we don't get into this mess ever again. But it's time for the wealthy classes who've done so very well out of the last 30 years to get their checkbooks out instead of lecturing the rest of us about what we need to do. And the point is, it's not just unfair, it won't work.
The argument that we've consistently made for urgent action to start tackling the deficit this year and an accelerated plan for eliminating it over the years ahead has already been backed by the Bank of England and the Treasury's own analysis. It has been made more urgent still by the sovereign debt crisis in the Eurozone over recent months. The global financial markets are no longer focusing simply on the financial position of the banks. They want to know that the governments that have supported the banks over the last 18 months are taking the actions to bring their own finances under control. And this weekend in South Korea, George Osborne received explicit backing from the G20 for the actions this government has already taken. Around the world, people and their governments are waking up to the dangers of not dealing with their debts. And Britain has got to be part of that international mainstream as well.
Well, the G20 are backing him, Martin.
Yes, well, I mean, we're basically being blackmailed by the financial sector. They collapsed 2 years ago. We bailed them out, and they're now saying, if you don't do as we say, we won't lend you any more of your own money that we've just paid in. We paid all this money over to them, and now they're making demands. This is all the wrong way round. We need, but there's nothing is going to change without political change. I mean, we talked about the Monetary Reform Party earlier and why it wasn't particularly well known. I'm obviously not a supporter of the Monetary Reform Party. I'm a member of the Labour Party. Nothing will change until people realise that they've been hoodwinked and stolen and basically conned. We've got to face up to the fact that the financial sector is the root of the problem. They created the problem. That's where we've got to find the solution, not by cutting ordinary people's needs and wants. That's completely the wrong way about it. Now, at the moment, people are willing to buy all of this because we've been brainwashed since birth to believe that the system we live in is the only possible system. But very soon it's going to become obvious, even to stupid people, that the system is not working. And then, and only then probably, will the political pressure build for changes. And then when those changes are going to demand reforms in the way we do things, one of those reforms is going to be monetary reform.
Okay, now let's have a listen to the final extract from David Cameron's speech earlier this week.
Greece stands as a warning of what happens to countries that lose their credibility or whose governments pretend that difficult decisions can somehow be avoided. Thankfully, this is a warning that's now focused the attention of the international community. That is why we believe there's only one option in front of us, to take immediate and decisive action. That's why we've already launched and completed an in-year spending review to save £6 billion of public spending. It's why shortly our new independent Office for Budget Responsibility will set out independent forecasts for both our growth and our borrowing so that never again can this country sleepwalk into such a massive debt crisis. Our actions have already been noticed around the world, and I'm glad the G20 summit this weekend explicitly endorsed the decisions that we've taken. So this is the sober reality that I have to set out for the country today. The legacy left by the last government is terrible. The private sector has shrunk back to what it was over 6 years ago. Unless we act now, interest payments in 5 years' time could end up being higher than the sums we spend on our schools, on climate change, and on transport combined. Because the legacy we've been left is so bad, the measures that we need to deal with it will be unavoidably tough. But people's lives, and this is vital, people's lives will be worse unless we do something now. The cause of building a fairer society will be set back for years unless we do something now. We are not alone in this. Many countries around the world have been living beyond their means, and they too are having to face the music. And I make this promise to everyone in Britain. You will not be left on your own in this. We are all in this together, and we are going to get through this together. We will carry out Britain's unavoidable deficit reduction plan in a way that strengthens and unites our country. We're not doing this because we want to. We're not driven by some theory or some ideology. We are doing this as a government because we have to, driven by the urgent truth that unless we do so, people will suffer and our national interest will suffer too. But this government will not cut the deficit in a way that hurts those we most need to help, in a way that divides our country, or in a way that undermines the spirit and the ethos of our vital public services. Freedom, fairness, responsibility, those are the values that drive this government. They're the values that will drive our efforts to deal with our debts and to turn this country around. So yes, It will be tough. I make no bones about that. But we will get through this together, and Britain and all of us will come out stronger on the other side. Thank you for listening.
Well, it sounds he's fighting tough talk there from Mr. Cameron Martin. What is your reaction to it overall? Because he's saying there basically,
he sounds like the headmaster telling us that it's going to hurt him more than it hurts us. And of course, when he says that we're going to, that this is all going to be very fair and reasonable, well, one thing we could do, for example, is cancel Trident, get rid of our aircraft carriers, withdraw from Afghanistan and Iran and Iraq. Oh, we're not going to do any of that. No. No, so where are we going to make these cuts? We were talking with Derek, the Labour councillor, earlier. I'll tell you where the cuts are going to be. They're going to be in adult social care. That's where they're going to be. That's what's going to happen. And of course, it won't even reduce the deficit, because when you cut like that, you're actually cutting demand in your own economy. It means you put people out of work. They don't pay any more taxes. You have to pay them benefits. This is what happened in the 1980s. They didn't even reduce the deficit.
But Cameron's saying he's going to be reducing the benefits bill.
Well, how's he going to do that? And if don't forget that the benefits bill is what keeps the economy up. Yeah, once you put people out of work, if you don't give them a benefit, then you've taken their demand out of the economy entirely, and you really are on a downward spiral. This sounds plausible, and it sounds plausible to many people, because from birth we're brought up to believe that the system works in a certain kind of way and we've all just got to work within that framework. It's just wrong. The financial sector is the reason why we've got a deficit. It's the bankers that are living beyond their means, not the ordinary people. Now what we should do is basically have a windfall. First of all, get some fraud investigations going, because a lot of people would argue that CBOs are all fraudulent.
There are fraud investigations going on.
There are, but
Goldman Sachs, for example.
Indeed, but they're not being pursued with sufficient determination. A lot of these people should be in prison and their money should be entirely taken off. Never mind raising taxes on them, we're taking all of it off you. That's the first thing. And the savings and loans scandal in the 1980s, hundreds of people went to prison and all their assets were confiscated. That's not happened this time. Now, this is where we need to be getting tough, and talking tough is with the financial sector. We don't actually need a lot of what they do. We could easily manage without it. Many successful countries do not have a huge bloated financial sector like Britain. Now, we've got to get to grips with this, and we've got these people are so-called invisible, untouchable. We've got to get to grips with the immediate crisis, which means taking the money off them and using it to make sure that we keep our level of demand up, and then we've got to reform the whole setup. And that's where things like monetary reform and other measures would come in. Because we don't want to get back into this mess ever again. If we cleaned up the mess now and allow them to go back to doing things the way they were before 2008, we'll get back straight into the mess again almost immediately. So we've got to act. This is the chance, a once-in-a-generation chance, once-in-a-lifetime chance to actually do the right things properly. But this is all marching in the wrong direction. We are lions led by donkeys. They don't know which direction to go in. They're telling us to go and attack the machine guns. They're wrong. We need to get our heads down and go around the side.
Bob Wellham, can I bring you in again from the Money Reform Party? Can you shed any light on this dispute, really, between the Conservative and Martin's old Labour point of view? Is this something you're familiar with?
I'm afraid not, Tony. I'm more of a theoretician. I'd like to introduce your listeners to perhaps different ways of thinking about money.
I think one of the problems is that a lot of the jargon that's used about economics is actually really quite difficult to get your heads around, and it's almost like an act of faith.
Particularly, there's an ambiguity between the words credit and money. A conventional economist will insist that the banks extend credit to the rest of us, and we go away and do our business and earn, having to use the word money because it comes naturally, we earn these numbers back and then we pay the banks back. They settle their accounts daily through what's called base money, which is the numbers that they use with respect to the central bank, the Bank of England.
Because this is the first time I've realised that there's maybe different sorts of money around.
But you've heard of M1, M2, M3. I mean, that's economist jargon, but the different measures of the money supply.
Yeah? Mm. Base money, which is issued by the Bank of England, we don't see it except in the form of physical cash. Now, physical cash, notes and coins, is only less than 3% of what's called the broad money supply, which is the money that you and I use to buy and sell stuff, to pay our taxes, etc., etc. The Money Reform Party would like to do away with this two-tier system and have just one form of money. Let's call it plain money, which was a phrase coined by James Robertson, a venerable British money reformer. Do look him up on Google if you are interested. We would like to move to this unitary system of money where you, as a citizen or as a business, you will own any money in your bank account. It will be your money. At the moment, the numbers, the money, the credit in your bank account, again, there's different words for it, is the bank's obligation to pay you. It's not real money in the sense that the base money is real money.
So are you saying that there's a difference between the money you're spending using your debit card, for example, and money that you have as cash in your pocket?
Yes.
Because it's interchangeable, surely.
It is interchangeable, yes, and that's part of the difficulty in seeing through it. Let's call it the electronic money you have perhaps in your savings account. You can look at it in your passbook, or you can go online and see the numbers there. Where did that come from? How did it get into circulation? You can spend it just as well as you can spend cash. You can spend cash at the corner shop or the pub and so on. You can spend this electronic money through your credit card, your debit card, etc. And it passes, it jumps from account to account as business proceeds. Where did it come from? There's 97% of our money is in this form. If you look back where it came from, well, it got into circulation because somebody somewhere at some time in the past borrowed it from the bank, maybe a mortgage, a personal loan, etc. And then it circulates around and we all compete to get hold of more of it, mainly to pay back what we borrowed from the banking system.
Okay, now just to go back to something we were talking about earlier, which is the Bank of England and the shares in it. Are you aware about of who owns the Bank of England, whether it's private or public? Because there seems to be a bit of a dispute about that.
I believe it's 100% public owned. It was nationalised after the Second World War, and I think technically the Treasury owns it, or Secretary of the Treasury, something like that. I'm not sure. But it's certainly publicly owned, yes.
Okay, now, on Tuesday this week, the Chancellor George Osborne announced that he was going to consult everyone in Britain about where we all think the cuts should fall. Well, you can't be fairer than that, can you? So, Marina Morris has been out on the streets to ask you where you think the cuts should be made.
If you were the Chancellor, what services would you cut?
Very good question. Personally, I think benefits, you know, get a lot of people off but don't need to be on. Unemployment, one area. Wouldn't like to see health defence in that cut, but if needs be, let's see how it goes. But yeah, that's a very tricky question.
I definitely wouldn't cut spending on roads. They're the worst they've ever been. I would try and cut some of the money going to financials so that bankers don't get as many bonuses. Maybe try and bring in some regulations there so that it caps how much people get paid. Maybe some cuts in the health, although that would be quite detrimental, but I can't see anywhere that actually that can actually take a cut, really.
I'd cut Trident. We do not need a nuclear deterrent that costs £97 billion. And that could be spent on so many other things, so many public services.
Gosh, I'd probably protect certain health services, but I might look at council spending more generally on newsletters and those kind of things, but try and protect education and health services. I agree with some of what he says, cutting down on the civil service people, but other than that, I can't think of anything else on the spur of the moment. You just caught me like that. I'd have to think a little bit more, but I hope he won't cut National Health Service.
What do we do about the financial crisis?
Tighten our belts, basically. That's what we've got to do. So everyone's got to trim down and save what we can. Same for everyone at the moment, so it's just see how it goes.
The financial crisis. Find some money from somewhere. We need better spending, especially from the MPs. They need to stop paying for cars that are going to take people 500 yards down the road. They need to just tidy up and smarten themselves up and give us an example that we can all follow so that we spend our money more wisely.
Well, it's a bit of a joke, isn't it? I think it's good that that people have to be more honest about the money they receive and about perks. you know, I think the whole expensive scandal was about time it came out. That sort of thing, basically, I think the gap between the haves and the have-nots has got wider and wider and wider. And, you know, there are loads of millionaires, probably. And I think it's amoral that these people are making masses of money. Well, for instance, a lot of the big companies, for instance, BT, I mean, they are absolutely extortionate. And I think all these companies need to be accountable to the public.
I think we all have to learn to live more simply than we do and not to expect quite so much. And that means raise taxes, which I don't mind paying, if it means that we get good services for the community. Tax the people who earn a lot of money, tax them a little bit more. Clamp down on benefit fraud, people that claim benefits when they don't need to. Just a couple of things that I can think of off the top of my head.
Are you expecting the economy to improve?
Yeah, I want to. Hopefully it will.
Hopefully. It's slowly improving, but I've heard rumours of that there's going to be a double bounce, so that everything's kind of going up a little bit, but then it's going to fall again. So hopefully it'll go up with all the spending coming up to summer and also the World Cup, people spend more. So hopefully.
Nope. Don't have such expectations. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, you can have hopes, but if you have expectations, they could be dashed.
No, probably not short term, no. I expect it to be quite difficult for the next couple of years. It will be a long time, I think it will, but I think it will be 2-3 years before we see a change.
So, Mark Martin, are we going to be saved by the World Cup? Are people going to be spending more?
I very much doubt it. It might do something for the economy in South Africa, although I've got friends in South Africa who tell me the situation there is pretty grim. I think what's the whole basis of that discussion is, what should we cut? And I would say that actually the level of public expenditure should not be cut, it should probably be increased. I would cut certain aspects of public expenditure, for example Trident, obviously ID cards, they're on the way out anyway. But you wouldn't, if you save that money, you wouldn't want to just hold it back, you'd then want to spend it on other things. You don't want to be actually cutting the level of demand in the economy. This is the fundamental error that the Conservatives are making. If you cut the level of demand in the economy goes down, and then people pay less taxes because they're out of work, and so on and so forth. So you don't actually, it's like anorexia, yeah? You just keep throwing up the stuff you're eating and you get thinner and thinner and thinner. What we need to do is fatten ourselves up a bit and look after ourselves. Now, if we can't afford that, then we've got to look at who's got the money. And various people were saying, well, there is money in the society, we know it's there. And those people really have done very, very well out of the last generation of economic policy. Nobody's saying they should lose all their money, apart from the fraudsters, but they've got to pay up now. They've done very well, it's all a mess. They're responsible, they've got to pay up. It's polluter pays. It's like the Bullingdon Club have smashed up the pub and now the bill has got to be paid. That's all there is to it.
Now, a couple of people there were talking about the expenses scandal last year and explaining that actually, you know, this is one area where there's been profligacy in the past and there's got to be cuts there, and well, government in expenses for MPs, that kind of thing.
Well, I mean,
and possibly a reduction in pay for MPs.
Well, that may well be so. But if people think that there was more money spent investigating the MPs' expenses scandal than the MPs had actually scammed out of the system. So if people think we're going to save the economy by getting MPs to bicycle to work, then they're living in cloud cuckoo land. The kind of amounts of money we're talking about are astronomical. People can get their heads around a £4,000 duck pond that wasn't even claimed for, but the idea that the banks have run off with £4 trillion, they can't get their heads around that, so they don't even think about it. Well, it's a confidence trick that's being pulled on the population here. The real fraud and fault is in the financial sector. It's not in the public sector at all, and that's what's got to be dealt with, and that involves reform of the monetary system, as we were talking about earlier. I mean, the fact is that most money is not actually under the control of the government at all. It's lent into existence by the private banks, and they get a fat fee for doing so. They are in the position of printing money, not the government, and it's not right. It's got to change. That's why we got into the mess.
Now let me bring Bob Wellham from the Money Reform Party back in again here. Bob, you were saying while we were listening to that that actually money is borrowed from corporations rather than sort of created by the Bank of England. How does that work?
Well, let me tell a little story that I hope your listeners can understand this. It appealed to me when I first started learning about this stuff. Imagine a society that has not yet invented money, it just barters, swapping chickens for goats and so on. And then some bright spark comes up with the idea of a universal means of exchange, which is like money, quantified purchasing power. And they decide how to implement it. Well, they all get together and say, well, let's have these tokens. It doesn't matter what they are. They don't have any intrinsic value, but we'll all have confidence in them and use them to trade our goods and services. Might be seashells or notched sticks or whatever. And you can see that that's a common sense view of money, and it would work perfectly well. And in fact, it's just like our physical cash that we use to buy and sell small-scale stuff. Now, the difference is that one person then comes along, let's call him Mr. Banker, and he says, well, yeah, these tokens are fine that you guys are using, but I've got some tokens that I'd prefer that you used. Here they are. I've got a big chest of them there. We won't run out of them. Now, the thing about these tokens is I'm going to lend them to you. I'm going to lend each one of you 100 of them to start with, and then you can trade, just like you're trading now, with your own tokens. The difference is, at the end of a year, I want back 105 from each of you, not just 100. That's called interest, and I deserve that because I'm supplying you with the money. This can work only if at the end of the year you'll have realized that there's not enough tokens in circulation now to pay the banker all of it back, so he has to lend more to keep up the money supply in society so that the economy can continue to proceed and hopefully flourish. This is the system we're in now. The money we use to conduct our business has been lent to us by a private money issuing banking sector.
So are you talking about the coins in my pocket, for example? No, they haven't been lent to me, have they?
No, they haven't. They're issued by the state. Well, you own them. Indeed you do. Yes, they're not. Well, they are a contract between you and the central bank, but the central bank is owned by all of us. It's the state issuing money. It's the collective of all the people involved issuing their own money for their own purposes. That's fine. Money's a great thing. It makes everything much more efficient. No problem. What I think the problem is, and what the Money Reform Party thinks the problem is that the bulk of our money, the supply of it to the rest of us to conduct our business, has been captured by quite a small vested interest minority, the commercial banking section, which is an incredibly profitable business to get into, because what you're essentially doing is supplying the rest of the people with numbers that they can use to trade with. It doesn't really cost you that much to produce numbers. But if you can demand bigger numbers back from the people every so often, and that's called interest, you're onto a real winner. To my mind, this explains why the bankers, the financial sector, do so very well generally. They have the best cars and the best houses. And
but hang on a minute, they were about to go bankrupt a year and a half ago, weren't they?
Yes, what I think's happened is they've overplayed their hand. It's such a great business to be in. The more you expand the money supply, the more profit you make, because more or less every pound out there in circulation, you've lent it to somebody at interest. So they got a bit carried away with this, I think, and expanded the money supply too much. And now it's expanded so much, and it's expanded into or through lending that can't be repaid, subprime mortgages, for example, that the banks are essentially bankrupt on their balance sheets. Their liabilities, which is your money in your bank account, my money in my bank account, what they've promised to pay us, now exceed the real value of their assets, which is what people have borrowed from the banks and promised to pay back to them. Because a lot of those people now can't pay it back. The economy won't support that level of debt anymore. And I think that's the fix we're in now. And to get out of it, I think we need monetary reform. We can't get out of the fix we're in using the present system. Something more fundamental has to change.
Okay, now we think of money as something finite, don't we? Of something, there's only a limited amount of it to go around. And yet, over the years, over the decades, of course, the value of everything is going up and up and up all the time, or the cost of everything is going up. So there must be more and more money around all the time, more pounds. So how does that work? Someone somewhere is creating these pounds, aren't they?
Yes, that's the scenario I outlined with this former barter society, that at the end of the year the banker is owed more than he lent out at the beginning of the year. Now, it's mathematically impossible that he gets paid all of that back. So he has to lend more, he has to roll over the debt and lend everybody 110, of which they pay him back 110.
So where does this money come from then?
He can write it into his balance sheets. This is how our broad money.
So is he actually creating it by doing that?
In that sense, he's creating the means of exchange. He's creating what's called broad money. Now, you can get into very heated arguments. Do banks create money out of thin air? Well, in one sense they do, and in another sense they don't. They don't create base money. The conventional people would say extend credit, which is a promise to pay eventually in base money. But this thing has got so big now that to all intents and purposes, what money is the bank credit money. That's what we use for our business, for our means of exchange. And the Money Reform Party really wants to rationalise that and say, look, that is money. That's real Bank of England, or it should be real central bank money. Let's make all money the same, let's have plain money, and let's conduct our business as that barter society initially did with their own tokens. So all money would be issued by the state, by the Bank of England, for the population to do their business, and no particular section of the population would benefit unduly from that.
So what would you be closing down, HSBC and the private banks then?
Not at all. It's the necessary reforms are very well documented in that website I gave at the beginning of the programme, bankofenglandact.co.uk, and also there's a very good document written by Joseph Huber and James Robertson called Creating New Money. Just Google that, you'll find it. The basic reforms are that, first of all, everybody's money in the bank, your balance in your bank account, becomes real money. It's designated as legal tender, the same as the banks use to trade with to deal with the Bank of England. So all money becomes the same. This money is now owned by you. It's not an obligation of the bank to pay you. It's actual real money that you own, just like you do with the pound notes in your pocket. It's electronic, but it has the same status as legal tender. Now, this takes off the bank's balance sheets a huge liability. Could be a great windfall.
Don't you think the banks might like that, actually?
Some bankers do, and in fact, some of the people behind the money reform movement are indeed bankers who can see very clearly what's needed. There are other stages. So that's taken off the bank's balance sheets huge liabilities, and what's still on their asset side is the money that's owed to them. So to counter that, instead of suddenly giving the banks £1 trillion or £2, the second part of the reform is to create equal liabilities from the commercial banks back to the central bank, the Bank of England, so that as the money comes in from the people who owe the banks sort of pass that on to the Bank of England. So they don't suddenly get a huge trillion pound windfall, that their books balance. Gradually, as new money is introduced into the economy, this time by the state, by the government, by the Treasury, the nature of money in circulation changes over a period of time to 100% debt-free money. Now, technically, debt-free money is issued by the nation itself through its central bank into circulation. Thereafter, it circulates persistently or permanently.
But is this a little bit like the quantitative easing, the printing of money that was started by Alistair Darling and is carrying on?
It has some similarities. Now, quantitative easing, let's take the case where the Bank of England printed new base money to by a gilt, a government debt. Now, if the bank itself owned that gilt, the transaction was fairly straightforward. The bank lost an asset of the government gilt, which it sold to the Bank of England, which paid the bank, the commercial bank, in new base money. Both of these, the old gilt and the new base money, are on the asset side of the bank. It's just traded one asset for another. This aided liquidity. It could now borrow and lend from other banks much more easily, had a lot more liquidity in that base money system. Bit more interesting is when the gilt, the government debt, was owned by a non-bank. And in that case, the Bank of England still created new base money, which went into the asset side of the bank's balance sheet. The bank now being the bank with whom the owner of the gilt banks. So if your pension fund owned a gilt and it had its bank account at HSBC, what would happen now is your pension fund would think that it was selling its gilt for broad money, and it would lose ownership of the gilt, but its bank account at HSBC would shoot up by, let's say, £1 million. And at the same time, the asset side of HSBC's balance sheet would go up by £1 million from the Bank of England, who would get ownership of the gilt. So your new £1 million in your bank account is a liability to HSBC. It means they owe you £1 million. That's balanced by their new base money from the Bank of England. It's a bit complicated. I need diagrams to explain it, so let's drop that for now. There is a very good document published by the Bank of England in their quarterly bulletin, which those interested can go and access and get it all thoroughly explained.
Okay, so this is a whole system that the your party has developed. Can you just explain it in the simplest terms? If you were Chancellor George Osborne, you know, you've talked about a couple of steps, but how can you explain in a nutshell how you would change the present system?
Well, those steps were part of the change. The effects would be that the nature of a bank would change. Our broad money supply exists on the balance sheets of commercial banks. What would change is that non-banks, people, you, me, corporations, would own the money, and the bank would be a custodian of that money. If you imagine it was analogously, it's all money exists independently of the bank's balance sheets. And when I leave my car at the airport, the company which runs the car park doesn't own my car in any sense. It looks after it for me. So that would change. The banks would become custodians in that sense, and they would also become intermediaries between a multitude of lenders, because not everybody wouldn't want to just leave all their money sitting in bank accounts, and borrowers. And they would perform this function with appropriate skill and risk assessment and propriety and so on.
Now, Martin, this is a lot to learn here. We've got a lot to learn to understand the financial system. Why don't we get taught about this kind of basic stuff at school? Okay, maybe people have done O-level economics, but a lot of this monetary reform idea isn't part of the economics teaching, is it?
There is a push to give younger people financial knowledge. I mean, there are programs in schools to teach about, you know, savings and the basic workings of the system. But don't forget that what we're talking about here is a massive vested interest, which is basically the private lenders of money. They've monopolised this institution. And in the 80s, if you remember the monetarist era of Margaret Thatcher, where they were talking about reducing the money supply in order to bring down inflation, and it didn't matter how much they reduced the base level, the broad money was carried on going up because the banks carried on being creative about creating new ways of making new money. So the link between the base level and the broad money has been broken by technological change. In the past, it was quite simple to say, well, you've got your base money, which is your cash, and you've got your reserve ratio. You've got to have 10% held with the Bank of England, and there was only a limited amount that banks could do to string out their seigniorage, if you like, their capacity to make money. But what's happened with the Big Bang, with all of the changes in technology and so on, money centre banks, that's what they're called, the big money centre banks, are able to create money far more creatively than they ever were in the past, and they're able to string out 40, 50 times the leverage they were in the past. And of course, ultimately, the problem with this is that it's a mathematical impossibility for all these debts to be repaid. And at a certain point, you reach a point where creating more money on debt doesn't solve your problem. And we've reached that point. I mean, this is the moment to actually start talking about these things, because we've basically been conned into pursuing a system which is not in the interest of the majority of people. It's not just a technical question. If it was a technical question, we could just say, well, technically agree and say, well, let's do it like that. The problem is that we're dealing with vested interests here. The vested interests of the banks, first of all, and then all the people who are bound up with the banks, the wealthy people who have money. This system has worked very well for them. They lend their money to the banks, and the banks make money very easily. I mean, at the moment, banks in the US, the big money centre banks, are borrowing from the Federal Reserve at virtually 0% interest, and then they can go and buy a treasury bond or gilt with 3.5%, and that's a 3.5% profit just for transferring the money from one thing to another. Now, this is what we've done at the moment is we've rescued the banks and we've rescued their capacity to carry on making profits for themselves, their shareholders and so on, but we haven't actually solved the problem. And of course, the governments are now running out of money to solve the problem. And in the past, it was actually, for example, during the American Civil War, Lincoln did exactly what's being suggested here. He printed his own money, the greenback. He didn't borrow from the banks. They were fighting a war. They needed lots of money. And he didn't want to borrow it, so he created his own money, and that worked very well. And in actual fact, they won the war precisely because of that financial policy. He was able to fund the Union's war effort by printing his own money.
But I thought President Lincoln was shot.
And that's one of the reasons possibly that he was shot, but we won't go into that. I mean, he was possibly shot just because the Confederates didn't like him winning. But the fact is that this is not impractical. It has been done in the past. And it's like a lot of things. People only look at the alternatives when the current setup is so broken that they have to look at the alternatives. I mean, there's a lot of inertia in human life. You know, relationships carry on longer than they ought to, and so on and so forth. But eventually, when you hit a real problem, you have to actually look at the real dimensions of that problem. We've basically given the private banks the right to control the money supply. The state has basically abdicated its responsibility. That's why we're in a mess.
Well, it's
the state. The state can still make mistakes, of course. Let's not get carried away.
It's the Labour Party.
The state could actually print too much money. That's perfectly feasible. But the banks have got a vested interest in printing too much money because that's how they make their money. They lend more, and then you get roaring booms followed by catastrophic busts, which is just what we've had.
But it's the Labour Party that's done that, Martin. You're a member of the Labour Party.
No, the Labour Party has basically gone along with all of this when they should have said no. That's been their big failing. They bought into all this nonsense and went along with it. And they were absolutely shocked and stunned when the whole thing collapsed a couple of years ago. They shouldn't have been shocked and stunned. It's been coming for years. But a lot of people, I mean, it's not that difficult to understand all of this stuff. Another reason why we don't understand it is because it's deliberately made to sound more complicated than it is. Oh, we couldn't possibly do that. We couldn't possibly do that. You just don't understand. Leave it to us. We're the experts. We're the multi-million dollar experts. But you couldn't possibly understand what we're up to, so just don't bother trying to regulate us or tell us what's going on. It's a con trick.
Bob Weller, Money Reform Party. Do you agree with that there's a deliberate use of language to actually try and sort of pull the wool over people's eyes with economics?
There's certainly obfuscation and ambiguity. It's interesting to listen to, say, the BBC financial programs or read in the press that the banks extend credit, but as soon as Joe Public has got his hands on it, it's your cash. And that's one example. A lot of that goes on.
A lot of these derivatives that can CDOs, you know, collateralized debt obligations, structured investment vehicles, they are actually traded as money. Yeah, that was another candy floss creation of money. Now, of course, all this money is worth nothing because it's worth nothing. But the banks created that, traded it, made profits on it, and in fact, many of them were actually creating deliberate junk bonds. That's what Goldman Sachs look as if they're doing, creating deliberate junk and then betting against it in another part of the forest. This is fraud. People should be in prison for this, and all of their assets should be confiscated.
Now, this is the week where David Cameron, the Prime Minister, announced his unavoidable deficit reduction plan. Bob, as a representative of the Monetary Reform Party, we're facing now quite massive cuts in public services, many public employees possibly being sacked. How could your party's policies change all that, do you think? Or could they?
Well, once the monetary reform is established, then all new money would come into existence, come into circulation by the Bank of England, the state apparatus, creating it and spending it. So instead of borrowing money as the state now does, and this money, remember, has already been borrowed into existence at interest from the private banking system in the past, it circulates around a bit, then the government issues a gilt at the moment, and people buy that bond off the government, and the government has more money to spend. Now, that would change in that after reform, the government would have the power to issue its own money to spend directly into the system. And this sounds scary, all the government just run away with itself and have huge inflation and they'd all go mad. You'd have to be very careful and set the system up so that the politicians of the day, the party in power, had no direct control over the issuance of money. They might, say, get elected on a mandate of 1% inflation, but thereafter the professional civil servants in the Bank of England with the monetary policy unit would have control over the issue of money. However, the national debt could be far smaller. It could actually be eliminated because, within reason, the state could issue its own new money to spend on what was deemed appropriate by the political climate of the day. Typically, it's quite feasible, this, because typically the you want the money to supply to match the size of the economy. This will avoid general inflation and deflation. And typically, the economy might grow 2 or 3% a year, steady state, gradually expanding, everybody getting a little bit richer. So you can easily issue that amount of money each year without getting anywhere near, in fact, what you would want to spend as a state. Even the core uncontroversial spending, which all people of any right or left will agree is a good thing to do, that amount of money will exceed what is necessary to print. So taxation would still be there.
So ultimately the government won't be able to say, oh, I'm sorry, there's not enough money to do this. If the decision is made democratically to do something, simply the money will then be just created to do it. Anyway,
you'd still have choices.
We're nearly at the end of the show now, but so Bob, I'd like just you to round off by just recommending us maybe a couple of books or a couple of films to watch. I mean, I know there's some internet films around, aren't there, which actually can in maybe an hour or a couple of hours really get you up to speed on these issues of monetary reform, if it's something that's completely new to you, as it is to most people.
Well, the one I start off with is made by my good friend Bill Still, who's an American journalist and a money reformer and primarily a filmmaker. And in the mid-90s, he made a 3.5-hour documentary called The Money Masters, quite a thorough investigation of the history of banking in the United States. It's available for free on Google. If you've got a spare 3.5 hours, have a look at it.
I can remember a quote from that film where at one point he says, the bankers started cheating on the system.
Sure.
Anyway,
back in the days of the goldsmiths is where it all worked out. They started issuing more promises for gold than they actually had gold in their coffers, and it's gone from bad to worse since then. If you haven't got 3.5 hours, then go to Bill Still's own website and buy a copy of his new film, The Secret of Oz, which is only about less than 2 hours long. That's his updated, slicker version.
Okay, and can you just remind us of your website for the Monetary Reform Party?
Okay, it's Money Reform Party, all one word, lowercase. I think it's .co.uk, it might be .org, I'm not sure. But if you just Google Money Reform Party, all in one word, you'll certainly get there and have a look at what various people have proposed there.
Well, Bob, Well, thanks very much for coming in this week. That's all for this week. Coming up next, the Sky News at 7 o'clock. Do please join us at 5 on Friday Drive Time each week here on BCFM 93.2. If you have a story for us, questions about this evening's programme, or would like to suggest a guest for a future show, please go to our webpage at thisweek.org.uk or email me at tony@bcfm.org.uk. Thanks to this week's guests in the first hour, Labour Councillor for Hartcliffe, Derek Pickup, and Marina Morris and Neil Evans. Next week, the environment. Mike Birkin from Southwest Friends of the Earth will be here.